All right, so coming back to the, what's it called again? Upakilesa Sutta, the corruptions or the defilements of the mind. And we have just seen how the Buddha is not too impressed with how his disciples are acting, his monastic disciples, and he decides to leave them. And as he's leaving, he speaks these famous verses that have kind of gone down in Buddhist history and become very well known, and they're found in many, many different places in the Tripitaka. And for that reason, we know how famous they were, how well known they were considered at that time. So now we're going to see what happens next, and where the Buddha goes, and kind of the various things that happens as he moves on. So then we have the story going after speaking these verses. While standing, the Buddha went to the Balakalona Gamaka, I think it's called. I'm not sure why he has translated the name, and it sounds a bit weird. It's the Balakalona Gama, which is the name of that village, where Venerable Bhagu was staying at that time. Bhagu saw the Buddha coming off in the distance, so he spread out the seat and placed water for washing the feet. The Buddha sat on the seat spread out and washed his feet. Bhagu bowed to the Buddha and sat down to one side. So the Buddha now, he goes off and he visits some monks that are considered good monks. Yeah, monks are not arguing and quarreling. And the first fellow he visits is this Venerable Bhagu. And there's not much information about this Venerable that I'm aware of. He occurs really just here, so we don't really know much about him. But presumably he was a monk worth for the Buddha just to stop and visit him. And it's kind of nice, isn't it? You're staying by yourself, Venerable, and then the Buddha comes on a visit. It's kind of nice. It's kind of extraordinary. And I guess he feels quite fortunate. And then, of course, he does the standard things. He spreads out the seat for the Buddha, and he puts out water for washing the feet. And the Buddha sits down, and interestingly here, the Buddha washes his own feet, which is kind of, again, interesting. And that is often these days you have monks getting their feet washed. And so this is, again, different and fascinating. So the Buddha sits down, and the Buddha said to him, "I hope you are keeping well, mendicant. I hope you are all right. I hope you're having no trouble getting alms food." Standard way of polite conversation that you find throughout the suttas. This is how the Buddha will always ask his monastics, that you are well fed and you are keeping well. And they reply, "I am keeping well, sir, I'm all right, I am having no trouble getting alms food." And then the Buddha encouraged, educated, fired up, and inspired Bhagu with the Dhamma talk, after which he got up from his seat and set out for the eastern bamboo grove. So this is a kind of typical encounter that you find in the suttas, quite commonly. This is sort of how things tend to be. And the Buddha has always said to educate, encourage, fire up, and inspire the person with the Dhamma talk. This kind of four words that are being used. And I haven't really looked into any great detail about these words, but the way it is translated here gives an idea of what the purpose of the Dhamma talk is. First of all, it is to educate you, to have knowledge and understanding of the Dhamma, the various aspects of it, the various categories that the Buddha talks about, getting an understanding of the Dhamma. And that understanding is like what you do when you come to Buddhism in the beginning. You want to learn about these teachings, you get an understanding for what is going on. But that is only a very preliminary purpose of understanding of teaching the Dhamma. It doesn't take all that long before you have a reasonably good understanding. A secondary purpose of teaching the Dhamma is to inspire you. This is kind of maybe the more important in the long run, is to be inspired, because it is the inspiration, again, which is the motivating force that makes you practice these teachings. Inspiration is emotional, inspiration drives you, inspiration gets you going, it creates that desire to practice. So inspiration is actually more important than the actual understanding of the teachings. So there is another nice instance where this is talked about. And the Venerable Ananda is asking the Buddha for a Dhamma talk, and the Buddha says, I've given you enough Dhamma talks. Something to that effect is what he says. And he says that when you get together and when you listen to Dhamma talk, it shouldn't just be, you know enough already. So when you listen to a Dhamma talk, it should be to be inspired, to kind of gain energy, and to be inspired in how to practice. Yeah, so there comes a point when the Dhamma talks have a very kind of clear purpose to them. That is to really inspire you, not to kind of gain more knowledge. And this is part of this thing when we talk in the suttas about Dhamma Nusati. Anusati is to recollect. Dhamma here is the teachings. So Dhamma Nusati means recollection of the teachings, and the purpose of that recollection, the way it is spoken about in the suttas, is always to give rise to inspiration, to kind of make the mind happy and glad. And the way this is described in the suttas, the Dhamma Nusati, how it works, is that you reflect on these teachings, and it could be maybe bringing up a certain passage or trying to reflect on that passage to understand what it means. Is it typically what Dhamma Nusati would mean? It can also actually refer to contemplating the content of your own mind, like defilements and overcoming them. But sometimes it refers to the idea of reflecting on the suttas, reflecting on the word of the Buddha. And then the way the process works, it says that by reflecting on that content, you get Dhamma Veda and Atta Veda. Dhamma Veda here is a word that means both understanding and inspiration, both feeling and understanding. Veda is the same word as related to Vedana, and also related to the word Vidya in Pali. Vidya is deep understanding, whereas Vedana is feeling. So it's related to both of those. So when we talk about Dhamma Veda, it is this combination of understanding and feeling and emotion coming together. And that is very similar to what we talk about in English as inspiration. When you're inspired by something, it means you understand. But inspiration also has an emotional component, something that drives you. You feel inspired in a positive way, and you feel driven to do things. And this is kind of the idea here with the Dhamma, to inspire you in this way, to drive you in this way. You get the Dhamma Veda, as says in the suttas. And then the Atta Veda. Atta is the goal or the purpose of something, where we want to head. The aim is the Atta. And so when you understand the Dhamma, the teachings, you also understand where this is heading. You understand the purpose of it. You understand the resultants, which of course are samadhi. They are awakening and all of these kind of things. So when you are inspired by the teaching, you're also inspired by the goal, the purpose of these teachings, where it is all heading. You understand kind of that this is what life is all about. Everything else is kind of secondary. This is really where it is at. And of course, that becomes a very powerful, motivating factor in your life. And then the sutta says that from that Dhamma Veda and Atta Veda, your mind becomes straight. The Dhamma, straight mind means that there is no defilements. A crooked mind is a mind full of defilements. And so your mind becomes straight based on the Dhamma. And then you feel this inspiring feelings. And when you feel that, you get Pamoja, I think, is the next one. Pamoja is like the gladness or the or joy. From Pamoja comes the piti, more joy. From the piti comes the pasaddi, the tranquility. From the tranquility, pasaddi, comes the sukha, happiness. From the sukha comes the samadhi, the stillness of the mind. And from that samadhi comes the yata bhuta jnanadasana, the seeing things in accordance with reality. And then it goes all the way to the end of the path. But it is driven by this inspiration at the root, that this is the significant part. So very often we understand enough. We don't need to understand all that much to be able to practice the Dhamma. In one place, the Buddha says, if you understand one four-lined verse, one verse or four lines, and understand it properly, you actually understand enough to practice these teachings. So this is what the Buddha does when he travels around and meets his monastics. He inspires them, he fires them up, and he arouses their interest in the Dhamma. And then they, of course, then they practice accordingly. And this is what we're seeing here. And this is kind of the purpose of this. So then he does this, and then after he does this, then he carries on and he goes to the eastern bamboo park, Pubbaramaha. It doesn't matter. Now at that time, the venerables Anuruddha, Nandaya, and Kimbala were staying in the eastern bamboo park. Yeah. The park keeper saw the Buddha coming in the distance and said to the Buddha, "Don't come into this park, ascetic. There are three gentlemen who love themselves staying here. Don't disturb them." This is a very peculiar translation. I don't know how he came with this translation. It sounds a bit weird. But attakama literally means someone who lives or who have their own benefit. Living for their own benefit. That's kind of what it means. Attakama, desiring the own benefit, is what it really means, how I would translate it. So here we have the three venerables, Anuruddha, Nandaya, and Kimbala, and they were all part of the Sakyan clan. And so they were kind of family members of the Buddha almost. They were staying in this eastern bamboo park. And as we shall see shortly, these are kind of the ideal monastics. Yeah, this is how you should live together. And it kind of contrasts with the monastics at Kosambi, who were the kind of the anti-ideal monastics. What is the word for anti-ideal? Anyway, whatever. Then the Buddha comes, the park keeper, they have like a park keeper looking after them, and he stops the Buddha. "Don't come into this park, ascetic." That's what he says to the Buddha. So again, the Buddha must have been not very clear who the Buddha was. The park keeper stops him. But he's kind of sweet. He's looking after his monks. These are my monks, I'm going to look after them. They are practicing really well. Please don't disturb them. That's kind of the idea. It is often like that. You can see the kind of the symbiotic, is that what they call it? Symbiotic relationship between the lay people and the monastics is often a bit like this. It's kind of, you have this relationship, and these are my monastics, and they belong to us, and these lay people support us. It's kind of this beautiful relationship between the monastics and the lay people. And you can see here how this park keeper, he sees these are my monks. Don't kind of come in here and disturb my monks. I look after them. And I will ensure that they kind of gain the maximum benefit out of this practice. And this often is kind of it's a nice relationship. But Anuruddha heard the park keeper conversing with the Buddha and said to him, "Don't keep the Buddha out, good park keeper. The teacher, the Blessed One, has arrived." Then Anuruddha went to Nandaya and Kimbala and said to them, "Come forth, venerables, come forth. Our teacher, the Blessed One, has arrived." Then Anuruddha, Nandaya, and Kimbala went out to greet the Buddha. One received his bowl and robe, one spread out a seat, and one set out water for washing the feet. The Buddha sat on the seat spread out and washed his feet. Those venerables bowed and sat down to one side. So again, the usual kind of how things start. And then the Buddha said to Anuruddha, "I hope you're keeping well, Anuruddha and friends. I hope you are all right. I hope you're having no trouble getting alms food." Anuruddha and friends, the Pali literally says Anuruddhas, Anuruddhas in the plural. And Anuruddhas in the plural means Anuruddha and his two friends. And they reply, "We are keeping well, sir. We are all right. We are having no trouble getting alms food." And then the Buddha says, "I hope you are living in harmony, appreciating each other without quarreling, blending like milk and water, and regarding each other with kindly eyes." "Indeed, sir, we live in harmony, as you say." And this is one of those sentences that you see in the suttas in a number of places, this idea of living in harmony, appreciating each other. And this is like a simple sentence, but if you look at it, it's actually very attractive. It's a beautiful idea of thinking about how we should live together, either as monastics or as lay people, or coming together on a retreat like this. Appreciating each other. The idea of seeing the good in each other. There's so much good to be seen in people who are living the life who are living the Buddhist life. And it doesn't take that much effort to be able to see the goodness in people around you. And when you see that goodness in the people around you, you dispel any little irritations, any negative thoughts that may arise, because the big picture is beautiful. The big picture is positive. You appreciate each other, right? And it's kind of simple, but actually at the same time very profound. Some of the things that we call profound are sort of profound in a different way from what we often think about profound. Profound, really, in Buddhism is about profound mental states. It's about mental qualities that are difficult to achieve because they are unusual. That's why they are profound. You need to develop yourself in a certain way. And appreciating, you know, in a real sense, the people around you is already a kind of profound mental state. Simple, yet profound. Often the profound things in the world actually are very simple. Without quarreling, blending like milk and water. Sense of uniformity. There's no one. Things don't kind of stick out. They don't separate. But you are kind of one mass, so to speak. And regarding each other with kindly eyes. Looking upon each other and seeing, having kind of a sense of kindness when you look at other people, feeling that they are kind, looking at the other in a positive way, having kindly eyes towards each other. Simple yet profound. And this is kind of what we should aim for. These are the ideal monastics, and this is what our societies ideally should be like. Indeed, sir, we live in harmony, as you say. But how do you live in this way? So here comes the recipe, how to live in harmony. In this case, sir, I think I am fortunate, so very fortunate, to live together with spiritual companions such as these. I consistently treat these venerables with kindness by way of body, speech, and mind, both in public and in private. I think, why don't I set aside my own ideas and just go along with these venerables' ideas? And that's what I do. Though we are different in body, sir, we're one in mind, so it seems. So this is how you live in harmony, right? This is kind of the very simple expression of what harmony means. And it starts off with this very really nice sentiment and something that is very hard to live up to. But it's kind of really, if you think about it, of course you're going to live in harmony if this is how you think. And it's a beautiful way of thinking. In this case, I think I am fortunate, so very fortunate, to live together with spiritual companions such as these. Isn't that a great way of thinking? When you look at your fellow monastics, when you look at your fellow lay people around us, and you think, wow, I'm so fortunate to have friends such as these. How lucky I am. It's difficult to find such high quality people in the world. How on earth did I get myself into this position? It's amazing. Wow, how fortunate I am. And of course, if you think like that, if you think that you're fortunate, harmony is going to be a given, right? Because you're going to look after those. If you're fortunate, you're going to look after them to ensure that they remain your friends, that they remain in harmony with you, because you want to be around them if you feel fortunate about it. And sometimes we forget our own good fortune. We forget the quality of the people that we are with. Again, focusing sometimes on the fault because it's such an easy thing to do in the human mind. We forget kind of the blessings in our life. But being in a community like this, having a companion such as this, is just extraordinary. And it's very, very difficult to gain and obtain such a thing. So we should avoid taking this thing for granted, but actually start to see the positivity in this. How fortunate I am, how very fortunate I am to have spiritual companions such as these. It's an amazing sentiment. That is how we should look upon the people around us. That is how you should think. Yeah, and if you can think like that, then harmony is yours, guaranteed. And so because you think like that, you are so fortunate, you want to help them. You want to do the right thing by them. Yeah, you want to kind of ensure that they hang around. You want to create an environment whereby they want to be with you. They don't want to be against you. And so because of that, you treat them with kindness by body, speech, and mind. Yeah, everything you do is you treat them with kindness because you want them to be part of your life, both in public and in private. Yeah, you are consistent, you have integrity in your behavior. This is kind of the idea of morality, yeah, morality taken to the highest extent. This is the idea of metta, of kindness, of friendliness, of compassion for the people around you. And this is why these monks are having success. Yeah, this is the way you have to think to have success. The idea of morality or good habits or ethics in Buddhism, or kindness in brief, it is very profound. And it's only when we really practice this all the way to the in the deepest level that it's going to be incredibly supportive of our practice. If you want to attain samadhi, this is essentially how you have to think. Yeah, having this real sense of positive feelings for the people around you. How lucky I am to have these people in my life. And what a wonderful support it is for the entire spiritual path. And then you do what you can, setting aside what you want to do, yeah, doing what they want to do, treating them well by body, speech, and mind. This is what it comes down to. So why don't I set aside my own ideas and just go along with these venerables' ideas? And that's what I do. Though we are different in body, sir, we are one in mind, it seems to me. So we tend to underestimate the importance of sila, or virtue. And by underestimating, what I mean is that we don't think about it all the time. That's what I mean by underestimating. It's kind of, it should always be at the back of your mind. It should always be there, because this is the thing that makes the path work. Get this right, everything else comes out of this. That's how important it is. So this should kind of be lodged at the back of your mind, imprinted in your mindfulness, so you never forget it. Then you are kind of on the right track. And the Venerables Nandiya and Kimbila spoke likewise, and they added, that is how we live in harmony, appreciating each other without quarreling, blending like milk and water, and regarding each other with kindly eyes. So that is, I don't know, I think for all of this retreat, this particular thing I've just been reading out now may turn out to be the most important part of everything, because this is what makes everything else possible. And if you're able to kind of gain this and kind of imprint this into your mind in a strong way, understanding how this is the foundation of everything, and then you always look out for opportunities, always look out for chances to be supported, to be kind, to be generous, to do the right thing, then you are really on the right track. And then you are guaranteed you're going to have results in this practice. Then the Buddha says, good, good, Anuruddha and friends, but I hope you are living heedful, keen, and diligent. I was yesterday, someone came to the interview, I'm not going to say who it was, and they rendered this exactly how I rendered it. They didn't say diligent, keen, or resolute. They said heedful, keen, and diligent, just like I said. And I was very impressed with them. They obviously been listening to what I've been saying, which is kind of very, very nice. Because I think that is actually a better way of thinking about this. It brings in the wisdom faculty in the idea of living well and being diligent. Indeed, sir, we live diligently, but how do you live in this way? In this case, sir, whoever returns first from alms round prepares the seats and puts out the drinking water and the rubbish bin. If there's anything left over, whoever returns last eats it if they like. Otherwise, they throw it out where there is little that grows, or drops it into water that has no living creatures. Then they put away the seats, drinking water, and rubbish bin, and sweep the refectory. If someone sees that the pot of water for washing, drinking, or the toilet is empty, they set it out. If he can't do it, he summons another with a wave of the hand. And they set it up by lifting it with their hands. But we don't break into speech for that reason. And every 5 days we sit together for the whole night and discuss the teachings. That is how we live heedful, keen, and diligent. So again, it's interesting, the idea of diligent here. Diligent here, I think the word probably is appamada, so maybe heedful is the right word. I didn't actually look it up, so I'm not sure what the Pali is. I didn't bring my laptop. That was a big mistake. Anyway, that's what happens. So you can see here the idea of what it means to be heedful or diligent. Yeah, it's kind of slightly different from what you might think. You might think, oh yeah, after a meal we sit down and we meditate for so and so many hours, and this is how we are diligent. But no, the diligence is actually measured in the things you do when you don't meditate. And of course, the reason for that is because when you do your meditation, you just sit down, close your eyes, bring up mindfulness, and it just happens. It's kind of almost like an automatic process that happens as a consequence of the things you do outside of meditation, almost. So this is kind of how this works, is my guess. And the idea here, you can see again, is this idea of living in harmony together, doing your duties, and if something needs to be done, you just do it, and then you work together, in a quiet way, in harmony. You don't even talk. You just kind of wave someone over with a sign of with a hand, and then you kind of lift it up together, and you don't speak according to this hardly at all. And this is kind of the idea of being diligent, doing your duties, doing what is required, and sometimes doing a bit extra as well, no doubt. And then every 5 days, you sit together the whole night and discuss the Dhamma. This is the Dhamma Sakaccha that you have every five days. That is how you are diligent, keen, and resolute. So I should say heedful, keen, and diligent. So there you are. Yeah, it's kind of a very simple way of doing things. And while you do this, of course, you look upon each other with kindly eyes as you do this. So that is the foundation. And now, having laid that foundation, we come to the meditation aspect that comes up next. And of course, that meditation aspect is really what we have been talking about here, is the mindfulness of breathing and these kind of things. That's what meditation is about. And so you will see, and this is what you see throughout the suttas, that the foundation for the meditation is really only one thing. It is the kindness, it is the morality, the virtue, the deliberately living well, deliberately doing the right thing, avoiding the bad things, deliberately thinking in the right way, perceiving in the right way, looking at people with the right kind of, in the right kind of way. That is the foundation for meditation. There's nothing else here. There's nothing else coming in. And of course, when you look at the Noble Eightfold Path, that is exactly what you see. Almost everything in the Noble Eightfold Path is about living well. Right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort being mostly about overcoming the negative states of mind. It is this path of purifying yourself, the path of morality, the path of ethics. And that is really all. That is the important thing. And then meditation just happens as a consequence. There's one more thing, of course, at the root of all of this, and that is right view. Because right view is what makes you moral in the first place. And that's why we spent a lot of time at the beginning on the idea of right view. So right view is behind this. Then comes the morality, and then comes the meditation. It's a very, very simple path. The hardest part of this path is to think in such a way that you get right view. That is the hardest part. Learning to look at the world in the right way. And it is worthwhile, whether you are a monastic or a layperson, to spend a lot of time contemplating the nature of the world around you, contemplating the nature of people, being able to see people in this way with kindly eyes, right? It is not obvious how you do that. And to do that, you need to recondition your mind. How should I think about these people? Okay, they don't know what they're doing. They are kind of conditioned. Why am I getting upset with them? Yet this is the nature of people that don't really have this sense of autonomy that I think they have. Okay, what does that mean? Well, it means I should think about them in this way. Yeah? And you contemplate that nature of the world. Yeah, it's fairly straightforward. It just takes, you have to do it again and again and again because the habits are so strong. Yeah? And a lot of the time we can spend, if we haven't got anything else to do, if there is no service to be done or whatever, reconditioning the mind in this way, pointing it in a new direction. And then the path just unfolds as a consequence. Right view, then living well, then meditation happens. So let's see what they have to say about meditation here. Good Buddha, Anuruddha and friends, but as you live heedfully like this, have you achieved any superhuman distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones, a meditation at ease? So these are the real these are the real purposes of the path. Yeah, this is what the path is lived for. And so the Buddha goes straight to the point. So have you achieved any of these real purposes of the path? So what are these things? The first thing here is a superhuman. The Pali word is literally uttarimanusa dhamma. Uttarimanusa means beyond the human, and dhamma means quality. Have you achieved any beyond human qualities? Quite literally. In other words, ordinary human qualities, if you like. Outside of the normal human experience. Uttarimanusa dhamma. And it's kind of a nice idea. It's almost like you become a deity. Yeah, you become like a Brahma. You become something more than the human realm if you have these kind of qualities. What are these qualities, these superhuman qualities? And they're always defined in the same way in the suttas. They are the four jhana states, the four states of profound samadhi, and the four stages of awakening, sotapanna, Sakadagami, Anagami, and Arahant. Yeah? Stream enter, once returner, non-returner, and the perfected one, the Arahant. These eight things are the things that are consistently described in the suttas as the purpose of the spiritual life, the superhuman qualities. And it's actually very interesting in its own right just to consider that for a moment. I mean, we can all get the idea that the four stages of awakening, that must be the purpose of the spiritual life. Of course it is, because idea is to awaken to truth, to awaken to reality, to understand the bigger picture of things. Because when you see things in accordance with reality, again, you can make good choices and you can live well, then you understand, and that for that reason, you are awakened. But what is interesting about this is that the four jhanas are always mentioned in the same breath as you find this, the four stages of awakening, always coming together, always forming this group of eight things, or sometimes larger groups, but always coming together in this way. Yesterday I said it was the Tathagata Pada. Tathagata Pada, footsteps of the Tathagata, the footsteps of the Buddha. These are also these eight things, right? Now we see them as uttarimanusadhammas, superhuman qualities. Again, it is very important to remember this, because when we talk about the jhanas, we're talking about something really, really profound. You've almost gone all the way to awakening. It is the very last factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. And when people say, oh, when shall I attain the jhanas? Oh, I want to attain the jhanas, as if it is something you can attain like that. But no, it is, if you get there, you're almost awakened already. Right? You might as well say, well, how come I'm not an arahant? You might as well say that. The same kind of idea. Hey, why am I don't want to be an arahant. How come this isn't happening faster? And it's silly. And it's very important to remember the profundity of these things. And in a sense, this is what makes the path so interesting. Yeah, there is like you start out on the path, you do some meditation, you get some joy and stillness and happiness, and you think, wow, yeah, this is it, this is what I meditate for. And then you meditate some more, and you get even more happiness and stillness, yeah. And you start to think, gee, this is how, where is this going? And you get more. And you start to read the suttas, and they talk about stage after stage after stage of more and more happiness, more and more tranquility, more and more peace, building up over time. And it's like, you know, it's kind of extraordinary. How can there be so much happiness in the world? And then eventually, as you build these things up, eventually you do get to these jhanas. But they are a very special, extremely developed kind of joy and happiness and peace. They are not anything ordinary yet. They are beyond the ordinary human realm. So we should expect something extraordinary, profound, on par with awakening itself. In fact, one of the qualities or one of the ways that the jhanas are described, they are described as the sambodha sukha, the happiness of awakening. Yeah, you are in the territory of awakening when you get to these jhanas. So don't, it's actually very important to get these things right, because if we misunderstand it, we are cutting off the possibility of awakening, because the jhanas are a requirement, and if you think that they are something less, basically you're never going to get there. So these are give you some indication of what is going on, and on the way there, there's just so much meaning, so much happiness, so much purpose, so much bliss. Yeah, it's like, wow, this path the Buddha laid out is just so extraordinary. And it's like I always say, how come the whole world isn't Buddhist? Yeah, there's so much happiness to be had, so much joy to be had, so much tranquility to be had, so much meaning to be had. Everyone should be a Buddhist. The only reason why everyone isn't a Buddhist is because we're not good enough at marketing these teachings. Yeah, that is the real problem. And we have to kind of learn to talk about these things in the right way. Not say everything is just dukkha, yeah, that's the path, it's all suffering, yeah, and practice, right? Dukkha, practice. No, that doesn't usually kind of, that doesn't kind of fire people up, right? You need something more than dukkha. You need to see the other side of the coin, which is the happiness. And very often it's that combination of understanding the dukkha, the problem on the one hand, but also having the carrot and the stick, right? The carrot also needs to be there. There is something really interesting to be experienced in this thing. Yeah? And don't tell them that or that really exciting thing is the ending of everything, right? That is kind of when everything is extinguished. Yeah, that's what you want to go for. And people say, okay, I'll just stay with the Muslims or Christians or whatever. Yeah, because not interested in this. So you have to be very careful how we teach these teachings. Maybe extinguishment is the highest happiness, but it's very difficult to understand that. Okay, this we can understand. Yeah, the blisses of the path, the powerful tranquility, everyone can relate to this. And so this is a part, very important part we should focus on. And when you start reading the suttas, it is everywhere, absolutely everywhere. And so the Buddha obviously made this a very important part of his teachings. The Buddha knew what people can relate to. So here we are, the Uttari Manusadhammas, the superhuman qualities. That is the first word that is used. The second word that is used is knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones. Yeah? Distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones. The Alang Arya Jnanadasana Visesa in the Pali language. So again, worthy of the noble ones. Yeah, the noble ones is the Buddha. The noble ones are all those people who achieve these stages of awakening. Yeah, so jhanas is something worthy of the noble ones. If you are getting into the jhanas, you're getting into noble territory. It is something very, very high. And one of the interesting things with this particular expression here, which suddenly is kind of weird. You read these words and you read these phrases again and again for years and you don't see it. But one day it occurred to me, actually, the jhanas are called knowledge and vision. Right? Distinction in knowledge and vision were the noble ones. No one ever really pointed that out to me. Not even Ajahn Brahm, I think, made that point. But actually that's an incredibly important point. Because not only does it mean that these things are really profound, worth of the noble ones, but the jhanas are actually a distinction in knowledge and vision. Knowledge and vision, jnanadasana, is precisely the purpose of the path. This is the outcome of samadhi. This is what we're trying to achieve, seeing things according to reality. But here, the jhanas themselves are called knowledge and visions. Yeah, and this tells you that this whole idea of the distinction in Buddhism on samatha and calming and samadhi on the one hand, and insight and knowledge and seeing things right on the other hand, actually it is completely, it's a fake distinction. In the suttas, these things always go together. They are two sides of the same coin. A jhana state is a kind of knowledge and vision. If you come out, you have no perspective while you're in the state, but the information that you get by being into these deep states of samadhi, when you come out afterwards, you know that this was special. It brings with it an insight into the nature of the world that is actually very hard to get otherwise. You are here getting some of the most highest insight and wisdom that is possible on the Buddhist path through the jhana states. And that is why you have, in verses like the Dhammapada, you have verses like there's no wisdom without jhana, there's no jhana without wisdom. Yeah, they go together. But when you have both jhana and wisdom, you are in the presence of nibbana, nibbana santike. Yeah, jhana, wisdom here is panya, jhana is just jhana, of course. So the things come together, they're not separated from each other. So what is the kind of wisdom you get? Well, the kind of wisdom that you get by being in jhana state is, remember I mentioned before that real wisdom is about seeing the impermanence in the world, right? Seeing the world according to the three characteristics, anicca, dukkha, anatta, anatman. Yeah, these are the three characteristics, the tilakkana. And we want to see in the world, we want to see our experience in terms of these three characteristics. And when we do that, that is what insight means in Buddhism. Now, if you come out of a jhana state, many things have disappeared during that jhana state. And disappearing, nirodha, cessation, that is one of the highest forms of impermanence. It is, in fact, the highest form of impermanence. When something is completely gone for long periods of time and you have no access to it, that is the full impermanence of something. So when you come out of the jhana afterwards, you look back, you can see all of these things having ceased, and you get a very profound insight into the impermanence of so many phenomena. The body, the five senses, the will, large parts of the perceptions that you have. Only very little perception is left in the jhana state, the perception of bliss. The only feeling that remains is the feeling of bliss. Yeah, the only consciousness that remains, the consciousness of the mind. So much has stopped, so little is left, so you are guaranteed to have profound insight after coming out. In fact, you need a lot of insight even to get into the jhanas, because to be able to let go of things, you have to understand that they are dukkha. You can only let go of something if it is dukkha. So to enter a jhana state, you have to already understand that the five senses are problematic. When you understand that they are problematic, which is understanding that they are dukkha, then you can enter these states. So you need a lot of wisdom to enter them. You gain even more wisdom when you emerge on the other end. Yeah. So these things there is no distinction between samadhi and insight and wisdom. These things always go together. They are two sides of the same coin. And this whole idea that there is a samatha meditation and vipassana meditation, that's not how things work. Or rather, you could say, if you do vipassana meditation, you also get samatha. If you do samatha meditation, you also get vipassana. They're just like terms that we use, but they don't really have any real content in that sense. So, allang arya nanadasana visesa. Yeah, another beautiful description of these superhuman qualities, the things that we're trying to achieve on the Buddhist path. So they are the jhanas, and they're also the four stages of awakening. Yeah. And then the last one, the last phrase here that describes these things is a meditation at ease. Yeah, pasu vihara is the Pali word. Pasu means that you are comfortable, you are at ease. And how do you become comfortable in Buddhism? By attaining the jhanas. Prior to that, you're not really comfortable. Yeah, you're still kind of stressed out and trying to be at ease, but you're not really at ease yet if you haven't achieved these things. So again, the Buddha is understated. Being at ease means like being really, really, really at ease. That's the only ease that counts. Everything else is dodgy. This is what the Buddha asks. And when he asks this, this is what Anuruddha replies. Well, sir, while meditating, or I should say here, living is a better word here. While living, heedful, keen, and diligent, we perceive both light and visions of forms. But before long, the light and vision of forms vanish. We haven't worked out the reason for that. We perceive light and vision of forms. The word for light is obasa. Obasa is one of the standard words for light in the suttas. And the vision of forms is the forms here is rupa. Huh? Yeah, rupa and obasa. These things are essentially what you see when you meditate and you kind of gain what is now these days called the samadhi nimitta sometimes. This is it. Yeah, this is how the samadhi nimittas are described in the suttas. Obasa and a vision of forms. And the reason is because when you have a samadhi nimitta, what you see is you see a certain shape, like usually a circle or something, and then you have a light, a powerful light in your mind together with a shape. So a shape or a form together with a light. That's exactly what a nimitta is. So this is the word for nimitta in the suttas. It doesn't occur that often, but it occurs here. The word samadhi nimitta also occurs in the suttas, but it means something else in the suttas. And this is why this can be quite confusing. And this is why we have to be careful to kind of keep our terminology apart. In the suttas, the samadhi nimitta means like the basis upon which you gain samadhi. Like the object, for example, the breath can be a samadhi nimitta, or a skeleton can be a samadhi nimitta if you like to contemplate skeletons. Skeletons can give rise to samadhi. In one place, they're talking about the charnel ground meditations, and you gain samadhi based on a charnel ground meditation, based on the idea of corpses being devoured by worms. You kind of gain all this joy and bliss based on that. It's true. That's what it says in there. It's kind of fascinating. Of course, one of the reasons why that works is because you overcome so much desires and things when you look at things in that way. So this is what we are talking about here. Obasa and rupa, light and shapes and forms. And remember, now what we are dealing with here are some of the best monks, the best monastics at the time of the Buddha. These were the monastics who knew what they were doing. They were living well. The Buddha goes to visit them to help them out, right? And what are they working on? They are working on the nimittas. They're working on these lights in the mind, right? And they are having problems with it. They lose them. That's what he says here. He says that before long, they vanish. And so this is really interesting because this is where many people today, you speak to people who are keen meditators, they too gain these things. There are many people here who gain these things. I haven't counted the number, but there are a few of you who gain these kind of insights. Monastics, of course, as well. So here, again, you get this feeling that we are practicing the same thing on the same path as the greatest monastics at the time of the Buddha. And this is really encouraging, isn't it? These are the greatest people in Buddhist history practicing these things. We are doing the same, achieving the same results. And now we're going to learn from them how to stabilize these things, how to make them work, how not to lose them for the future. So this is really, this is kind of, you feel that you are doing the same thing as the greatest arahants in history. And of course, what we will find out in a second, that the Buddha-to-be himself was having similar problems. How did the Buddha-to-be resolve these things? And by listening to the Buddha-to-be or the Buddha, we're going to learn exactly what it is that we need to do to stabilize these images in the mind and then carrying on and go even beyond that. So I don't know about you, but I find this really inspiring precisely because it is talking to us so directly. It is connecting us with some of the greatest people in the history of Buddhism. Direct connection, and we can learn directly from them. So let's see what happens. So the Buddha responds. First of all, they say, we haven't worked out the reason for that. And then the Buddha says, well, you should work out the reason for that. before my awakening, when I was still unawakened, but intent on awakening, I too perceived both lights and a vision of forms. But before long, my light and vision of forms vanished. It occurred to me, what is the cause? What is the reason why my light and vision of forms vanished? It occurred to me, doubt arose in me, and because of that, my immersion fell away, and my samadhi fell away, in other words, and when samadhi falls away, the light and vision of forms vanish. I will make sure that doubt will not arise in me again. So again, the Buddha before his awakening, he similarly, and same kind of problems, but then comes the solution to the problem. The solution is to inquire into causes. What is the cause? What is the reason? This is always how the Buddha goes about things, asking why things are happening. And this is what we should always do in our life as well. Inquire into the causes. What is it that drives the processes? What is it that blocks us? And the causes are what really matters. What is it? How can we get motivated? Etc., etc. And the first cause that the Buddha to be encounters is the doubt arising in the mind. And when you have doubt, then your samadhi falls away. And when the samadhi falls away, the light and the vision of forms vanish. So what is this doubt? And the Pali word here for doubt is vicikicca. It is the same word as used for the five hindrances. And what does that mean? And what it means is that you become unsure about the way forward. You become unsure about what are the really skillful and unskillful qualities. What is truly wholesome and what is unwholesome? And that is a reference both to the qualities within you. Okay, right now, my meditation is kind of coming to a plateau, not going any further. What are the things that I'm holding on to? What are the qualities that are blocking me from going further? And you're not sure. You have doubt about it. You are doubting. What can it be? I don't really understand. Because actually, it is quite profound and difficult to see these things sometimes. Everything seems about right. So how come I'm not making any progress? This is the inability to distinguish between the wholesome and the unwholesome. There are qualities in your mind that are unwholesome, but you can't really see it properly. And so what you need to do, you need to investigate. You need to look again and again and again to try to understand what is happening here. And you can also use your confidence in the Buddha to some extent. The Buddha talks about what usually the problems are in meditation. Usually they are connected with attachment to the five senses and the body and these kind of things. So you can take that as a starting point and contemplate these things in such a way that you abandon that attachment or whatever. So this is the idea of doubt. And you know what it's like. As soon as you doubt something, it's the opposite of confidence and faith. And as soon as you get doubt, the mind is not bright anymore. The mind loses its inspiration, right? Wait a minute, what am I doing? What's supposed to happen next? There's no inspiration there. It is the opposite. So this is why doubt is a problem and why we need to overcome doubt, because it blocks you. Doubt can also be doubt about the teachings, what kind of teachings are good and bad. But here, I think it has more to do with the mental qualities. So it's interesting, this idea of doubt in Buddhism, because it is a problem. It is something that we need to overcome because it stops the joy and the happiness in the mind. But at the same time, the Buddha also says that doubt is sometimes right. Not in meditation, not when you're trying to follow the breath, then doubt is counterproductive. But sometimes doubt is okay, because sometimes there are things in the world that are doubtful, they are uncertain, right? And so of course you're going to have doubt if something is uncertain. And doubt is not something that should be pushed away or dispelled by an act of will. It is something that should be inquired into. And then when you inquire into the underlying issue, what you're having doubt about, then from that you will find a resolution. And then you can move on. So when something is doubtful, it is okay to have doubt. It is like the idea of rebirth. You may not know that there is rebirth, so maybe you have a little bit of doubt about it. I don't know how you feel about it. And that is okay, because it's difficult to know. Of course, for me, it's kind of obvious if the Buddha says there's rebirth, then there's rebirth, end of story. That's kind of how I see it. But it's kind of acceptable that it kind of to be expected that some people will have doubts about it because you cannot see it directly. So there are doubtful things in the world. One of the places where this occurs and where the Buddha says it is okay to have doubt is in the famous Kalama Sutta, also called the Kesiyaputta Sutta. And this is where the Kalamas, they say, oh, you know, all of these various ascetics, they come and they tell this, another ascetic comes and then he tells the exact opposite. And a third ascetic comes and he tells exactly the opposite of the two first. Yeah. And we have doubt about who we should believe. Yeah. Because if we believe in one, we have to reject the other. If we believe in the other, we have to reject the one. These are mutually contradictory, what these people say. And so the Buddha says to them, well, you have doubt in a doubtful matter. There's a natural to have doubt about these things. And then he gives them this beautiful Kalama Sutta on how to inquire properly based on your own experience and then resolving the issues through applying your own experience as a measure for what is right and what is not right. So doubt is sometimes good, sometimes bad. Here in meditation it is bad, and it can cause the joy and therefore the light and the forms to disappear, yeah? Because the doubt kind of gets in the way. So you overcome it, you inquire into it, you understand what the issue is, and then you go beyond. This is then the right way of doing this. Okay. There is only like 1 minute left of this session, so I think maybe this is a good place to stop. We have just gotten started on the various obstacles for the deeper states of meditation, and we're going to look, of course, at all the rest of these things. I like the idea of taking a lot of time on suttas like this because, to my mind, sometimes certain suttas just really inspire you because they are so beautiful. There's so much interesting content, and so it's worthwhile going really, really slowly through these things. There you are. That is all for this afternoon. Please keep on enjoying yourself. Have a good time. Live in harmony and see each other with kindly eyes. And then we'll come back again and we'll continue at 7 o'clock this evening. Yeah.